Now, Sean, the Kevin match, and ye had a very, very narrow escape. The whole thing nearly came asunder, didn't it? Tell us about that game. What date was it?
That was August 14th. It was about 3 weeks after the Munster final. And that 3 weeks I availed of in the way I've been talking about. And this Cavan team, remember, had Pat Carlin, Tom Maguire, Victor Sherlock, the Gunnar Brady, Peter Donoghue, Brian Gallagher. These were top-class footballers. And an interesting thing is the Cavan team used the same footballing schemes as Dublin appeared to be monopolising. Now, Cavan were a very smooth, fluid team. A lot of running, but they did play a lot of kicking as well. But they appeared to be a very good team on their displays right up to this stage in August.
You drew 2-10 to 1-13, but you were lucky to draw, weren't you? Oh. And Johnny Colletti made his debut, and luckily enough he was playing because...
Johnny Colletti was a revelation that day. He got a high centre and he fisted it to Tighe line, kicked it, I'm not terribly sure, but Tighe put that ball in the back of the net and that won the 1955 All-Ireland, Strange Messing.
Because if that goal hadn't come, you were gone out. There'd be no draw.
We were gone. And it'll just show you that at that stage of the game, there was very little between the All-Ireland semi-finals at that stage. Dublin were streets ahead of the other three.
Now, another man who was playing all up along, but unfortunately he wasn't playing in the All-Ireland final, was Bobby Buckley. We haven't spoken about him, and he had been played. Now, while all the heroes of 55, and like yourself and all, are well remembered, there was other people. Bobby Buckley was one of them.
Bobby Buckley was a very fine performer. I remember him playing in the Sigerson's as well, and he was playing left half-back against Cavan. And I think he was very unlucky to be displaced by Colm Kennelly. And Colm Kennelly, remember, had come back on the scene. He'd been working in South America, and he'd won a minor All-Ireland with Kerry in 1950. He was a very fine footballer, had a magnificent kick off a dead ball. And I think, again, that Bobby Buckley was a bit unlucky that Colm returned at the juncture in which he did.
The other subs that they shined in that were involved in that drawn game?
Marcus O'Neill. Who'll ever forget Marcus?
Yeah.
Dermot Dillon of Dwarf, Pop Fitzgerald Ostenstack, Paddy O'Donnell of Ostenstacks, again, another minor of 1950. So the subs were very, very strong and very good footballers.
And of course, another man who came on late in the game that day.
Ned Fitzgerald. Again, reminded me a lot of Mick O'Connell later. Not comparable to Mick, but had a lot of the characteristics of Mick O'Connell's play. Great fielder, very tidy footballer, very strong.
And of course, he gave us one of the all-time great footballers of latter years, didn't he, in his son?
He did. He did. What a footballer. What a footballer. I'll always remember that magnificent kick from the right, almost goal line, against Dublin. Who'll ever forget
that?
The
old enemy in Torlas, Sean.
That's right.
Magnificent kick.
Magnificent.
It wasn't. And as you say, Marcus O'Neill, in my opinion, one of the most unlucky goalkeepers never to have won in All-Ireland. Great goalkeeper.
Marvellous goalkeeper. Brave. You couldn't get past Marcus. He was a goalkeeper, but when he came out with the ball, he was ferocious, that man. He got through many a forward line. He did.
Now, Sean, things were to change and change utterly after that drawn game, because you were to come into collective training. We'll talk about the replay before we delve into the final, as the fella says. And Dr. Raymond, who we'll discuss later, also came on the scene. So, the replay was to come up. What are your memories between the drawn game and the replay in relation? Were you home on holidays? Were there people contacting you? Where were you? Or what was the situation?
I was home in camp. I had developed a training regime of my own. I walked for miles along the roads, and I wore a pair of hobnail boots. when I was walking, I would walk anything up to 12 miles a night. If I hadn't been walking the night before, I would climb the foothills, a little hill overlooking camp called Corrig, with a gun and a dog, again in hobnail boots, and I would roam those hills until nightfall. And I often try to sprint up so that I was a very, very fit, I think, when it came round to the call for collective training.
Now, tell us about the call and where you stayed. And you stayed in the Park Place Hotel, I presume, in Killarney, which sadly is now demolished and gone completely, owned by the O'Donoghue family. So, Sean, you got the call. Tell us, how did the call come about? Did somebody notify you, or when you met all the rest of the lads?
I got a letter asking me to present. I still have a copy. I still have that letter to present myself at the Park Hotel in Killarney on a particular date. Yeah. And that was it. Just one line for the Kerry County Board, signed by Jerry McCarthy, who was the secretary then.
Now, and we let the training regime rest until we come to the big game, the Dublin game, and we'll talk about Dr. Raymond. But Dr. Raymond came on the scene then, is that right, for the replay, Sean? Is that the first time he came on the scene in 1955?
My recollection of it is, I think he came on the scene then.
He had much time with you?
No, he didn't have a lot of time with us at that stage, but just as I said, I think that a lot of the players had made themselves much fitter, and getting together on the Raymond was sometimes almost a rest for some of them, and I think they were converting big muscles into sprinting muscles.
You must have, Sean, because tell us about what happened that day. When was the...
That was... on the, let me think, the 21st of August, it was a dual header in Croke Park. It was the most unusual day.
Yeah.
Probably the best value for money for Gaelic football followers ever. You had Cavan and Kerry and Dublin and Mayo. Dublin had drawn with Mayo.
And as you pointed out earlier on, Dublin were beginning to get tired now.
They were. I think they peaked. I think they had peaked, strange it may seem. And we were still in the formative stage. We were developing. And Dr. Raymond handled it very delicately. I think he specialised at that stage in welding us into a team rather than too intensive training, because we'd only played a week or 2 weeks before that.
And you pointed out to me there was 90,000 people present at Croke Park that day for those two replays. And tell us about the Kerry game and what you won by.
We won by 4-7 to 0-5 points. Cavan collapsed, really. Inexplicable, I would call it. John Joe Sheehan heralded his arrival by getting a goal. Johnny Colty got a goal, and Mick Murphy got two goals. That was devastating for the other teams.
4-7 to 5 points, Sean, that was a huge win.
It was a huge win, and it just, that set the stage for the final. You could see that Kerry were getting sharper, and they had an appetite for the game, which even surprised ourselves.
Did you see Dublin playing the replay? Did you stay around that day for the replay?
We saw part of it.
We saw part of it.
After you played a full hour in Croke Park, it was a warm day as well, I can remember it. And by the time we got into our clothes and whatnot, we saw the second half.
Yeah. And evidently the team was staying, Barry's, up until the final. You didn't. We'll come to that later on. You didn't stay there for the final, but Barry's was the was. I stayed there myself a couple of times with the Kerry teams in the 60s. But Barry's was your 18 houses to fill
it in. It was not ideal. There wasn't a lot of sleep sometimes got by the teams. I remember at one occasion putting my bed together for the fourth time about 4:30 in the morning. But that was part of the lore of the game. There was a room there which Gaffney Duggan called Aegis Ward. There was about 12 or 14 footballers sharing a huge big room. So the Barry's was, it was good fun. It was comfortable if you could get to your bed.
You mentioned Gaffney Duggan, lovely men, not to miss them.
All these characters, it's such a shame they're not around anymore.
So Sean, you were preparing for the big final against Dublin. What were the arrangements and were you contacted about it? And
we went into collective training in Killarney and we stayed in the Park Place Hotel about 2 weeks before the final. We went up by train, met by a bus and taken to Portmarnock.
Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan had come on the scene, as we said originally, for the semi-final. Now, you and everybody involved that year accepts that he played a vital part in the win for Kerry that year. He trained 8 All-Ireland winning teams, but 55, his late son told me, was his special memory. What had he, Sean?
I have memories of Dr. Eamon. His presence seemed to dominate the footballers. He was bigger than the team itself. His demeanour, the way he stood, the confidence that he exuded. When you met Dr. Eamon, you felt he is going to win this match for us. His personality, very strong personality, and dominated any gathering of footballers, officials, didn't matter. Eamon's presence was felt.
And of course, he was a psychiatrist, wasn't he? And he was the RMS in St. Finan's Hospital in Killarney.
He was. He was used to dealing with people. His job commanded a lot of respect, and his background being his father being the old champion, O'Sullivan champion from Killarney, this seemed to precede him, this presence that he had.
How did he handle the players, Sean?
He took complete control of the 25 or 30 players involved. He didn't impose any great plans or strategies. It was business as usual, but once or twice you got an impression, particularly we'll say when we were out walking in the morning, which was generally a 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 mile walk even before breakfast, and you would notice that he on more than one occasion seemed to accompany a particular player at the back of the line of walkers. And I can still see him having a chat with Ned Roach, presumably discussing Heffernan. But the rest of the team carried on as usual. What he said to these people, I can remember him taking John Cronin. I remember him being involved on a one-to-one basis with particular players through the whole 2 weeks. What he said to them, I don't know, but he seemed to immerse them in, I suppose you would almost call it, a psychological process. I'm not sure.
Now, you have vivid memories of his schedule in training, haven't you, Sean? And it was unique, the way he set out and planned the whole day, from wake up in the morning to go to bed at night. Could you bring us through that routine?
He supervised the footballer for 24 hours a day, strange it may seem. 8 o'clock, you got up early, went for a walk, you assembled and went for a short walk. Well, a short walk was often 2 or 3 miles, so that you had a good appetite for breakfast at 9 o'clock. Then 9:30 to 10:30 a.m., could you believe it? Complete relaxation. Back in line, the beds or anything, but no hyperactivity. Just take it easy. Then at 11 o'clock, you assemble in the Baratta training ground for a short lecture and field manoeuvres and full togs. Now, this was not a very intensive hour or half hour, whichever, and that took you right up to lunch at 1:30. From 2 to 3:30, 1.5 hours, complete rest, relaxation after this main meal. This lunch was his chief meal. Then at 4 o'clock, you assemble the training ground for a short lecture and further exercise. Now, further exercises were really tough. 6:30 to 8, complete relaxation again after an evening meal at 6. Then 10:30 p.m., walks, recreation. 10:30, a supper meal. 11:30, retire. And 12 midnight, all lights out. Now, this was his schedule, strictly adhered to, and he certainly would take a very, very poor view if he heard of any indiscretions or anybody who wasn't adhering to this schedule. And I can honestly say, with such a diverse crowd of personalities, drinking, carousing, any such like, just didn't happen.
We could stay talking about Dr. Eamon until the cows come home. Sum him up for me briefly, Sean, Dr. Eamon.
A big man, a big presence, imposed himself without effortlessly on the team. The team knew of his reputation, and I think you had the footballers said, if I want to win an All-Ireland medal, I'll just go along with Dr. Eamon. And that was a difficult thing to get across to 20 or 30 people.
And of course, unusually, Sean, he wasn't a selector on the team. So he wasn't.
He wasn't.
There was five selectors, but that's he right. wasn't a selector.
He wasn't a selector, but by Jove, he had an input into it. Yes. You had John Joshee and Jackie Lyon, Johnny Walsh, Paddy Bourne and Michael O'Shea. I believe he was in on the selection, and his contribution was very pertinent and probably influenced the final selection a lot.
Can you remember what was his final speech, his final talk, Sean? What did he tell you, tactics that he imposed on you, if there were tactics? What did he say to Kerry before the 1955 final win over Dublin?
I can still visualise him standing in front of a blackboard with a piece of chalk, having one or two arrows from the back line, and one or two arrows in the forwards, as if the corner forward got it, just to get it centred at about 21 yards out, that type of thing. But in general, there was no set plan. He advised you to watch your sector, dominate that. That's all he expected of you. And he really left it up to the players themselves. I remember him saying, I know you can all play football. During training, there wasn't a great emphasis on the skills. He assumed that the skills were innate or born into the players. He didn't try to influence that, but he tried to create team spirit, which is frightfully important. And he tried to analyse the other team, like the Dublin team. Didn't analyse the Kerry team, strange it may seem, but I remember him giving his impression of the team we were supposed to meet, and more or less saying, business as usual. But Ned Roach, he did give some instructions, Ned Roach, and his instructions, like everybody else's, you stay in your sector and everything will work out.
Finally, about Dr. Eamon, two questions in one. Was he ahead of his time? And if he was here today, would he be successful?
The basic principles of training, as distinct from the physical fitness point of view, are still the same. The development of the players, I could talk about for the next, of the body, I could talk about for the next 20 minutes, because the old players, Paddy Bourne-Brosnan, Bill Casey, Dan O'Keefe, their physique was developed on the farms and in the jobs they had. You didn't have to develop upper body strength in Paddy Bourne or Bill Casey or Giga Connor. It was already there. Today, the emphasis would be on building upper body strength and possibly the core musculature of the body. And I'm pretty sure that Eamon would be quite au fait with that. And perhaps he would change the development of the muscular physique more. I think he'd be quite capable of doing that. And incorporating that into his routine, I think he would be at home with any trainers today.
Has his contribution to Gaelic football been rightly acknowledged in the Gaelic Athletic Association?
I don't think so. It isn't part and parcel of the Gaelic Athletic Association officialdom to acknowledge anything. It wasn't then and it isn't today, I think.
And a story for another day, Sean. Now, the build-up in Kerry, was it huge? Of course, you hadn't the big media coverage, you hadn't local radio, or you hadn't television, or you had nothing that time. The build-up to it, and the run-up to the game, how did you travel, and you didn't stay in Barry's. Bring us through that.
The build-up to the game was, I'll take you back to the pre-television era. And there was a lot more physical contact between the players and supporters. Everywhere you went then, people recognised you, came along to the chat, and that was something which I think has been lost, overexposure I would call it, on television. So that side of it is quite different. Then the media, particularly the newspapers, were very much to the fore in commenting on the events of the day, like the forthcoming matches and whatnot. And this instilled a great enthusiasm in the followers of the teams involved in the matches. In Kerry, it was palpable. The excitement was, you could feel it when you walked down the street, that people, there was a buzz about the place.
And you stayed in Killarney, Sean, for 2 weeks. You stayed in the Park Place Hotel, didn't you? All the players did, like.
Yes. Yes, yeah. We stayed in the Park Place Hotel, yeah. but we were off out in walks and this sort of thing, and we could see the excitement in people's faces.
And the O'Donoghues, who owned the Park Place Hotel, they were a wonderful family in relation to Gaelic games.
Their contribution to Gaelic games is inestimable. The way we were treated, the quality of the rooms, the food, the people, Mrs. O'Donoghue, her family, were all involved. Seamus O'Donoghue, I remember him then as a young university student. And they really gave a home from home and created the right environment for Eamon to bring the best out of his team. The food there was excellent. The rest, recreation, you couldn't improve on it, I think.
What are your memories of travelling to Dublin for the final? Did you leave in the usual 2 o'clock, and when you landed, and what was the atmosphere like, and what was being said, and who were you with, or who did you stay with?
That's right. We got on the train in Killarney. No, I think I got on Tralee, as a matter of fact, because we came home to get some clothes, I think, for the final. It was a 2 o'clock train from Tralee, and by the time we had got to Killarney, most of the team, I have a feeling that, yes, most of the team travelled on the train. We were playing cards on the way up. We had some light refreshments, and every place we went, right through to Mallow, there were people who knew we were on the train, and they were waving, and the excitement was intense. You could feel it as you went along, that something big was about to occur, which was the match.
And Dr. Eamon changed you from Barry's Hotel, didn't he? For the first time. That was a big thing.
This was a surprise. This was a secret, where the team was staying. We generally stayed in Barry's Hotel all my life. We stayed in Barry's Hotel. But when we got to Kingsbridge, it was called then, we boarded a bus, and it was like a mystery tour. We didn't know where we were going. But eventually we finished up in Portmarnock, and that was splendid. It was the old Guinness residence. We stayed there overnight, mass early next morning. We togged out, did a little bit of exercise, very, very little, just limbered up, and then the great day was about to unfold.
Did he bring you together in the morning in the room? Was there a pep talk or a team talk?
No. It was all low-key. The whole thing was low-key. There was a photograph taken, I think, in Portmarnock. But Eamon O'Sullivan was never a man for his work was completed in Killarney. And he just supervised us, calmed us, went around that night to make sure everybody was comfortable. And there wasn't any pep talk. Not even in the dressing room before.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the dressing room. What are your memories of the dressing room? The old wooden dressing rooms there were then, of course, underneath the stand, where you'll get a chip off the floor onto your leg very quick. What are your memories of the atmosphere? Are the selectors, are the people walking around? What was it like in the dressing room? Could you sense the history beckoning you?
I did. I sensed. It was pretty primitive, those dressing rooms, compared to what they have today. And I'll always remember a pool, almost like a swimming pool, but I never saw any water in it in all my years playing football. I remember getting togged, ready for the game. We were sitting around, tying our shoelaces, and there was a peculiar calmness about the place. The selectors were there, they were chatting to each other. I can't remember any particular pep talk. I can still see an official from the GA coming through into the dressing room to announce it was time to go on the field.
And it's reputed, it's said, even though I was at it myself, I was only 14, my memory is very hazy, that Dublin raced onto the field and that Kerry ambled onto the field. Right or wrong, Sean?
Quite right. They performed exactly as they did in 1949 in Tralee, with their came on, they ran around, dazzling, intricate football, had two or three footballs, kicked and played around as if they were wound up to an extreme degree.
Were you nervous?
No, I wasn't nervous. I was never nervous before a game. And I can't recall any of the Kerry team that you could apply the word nervous to. They all seemed to have a calming influence, and Eamon O'Sullivan imposed this calm atmosphere from the top, and it seemed to pervade the whole team. All credit to Meath. Looking back on it, I have no doubt that the problem with collective training was a decisive factor there. Kerry were a team. Teams demand that they play together, not as individuals. We had a couple of footballers running around in Dublin. I'm purposely not saying training very hard, with some of them training in Killarney, a few of them training in Cork. That was not the way to approach an All-Ireland. And it was something new for Kerry, who were accustomed to collective training. I remember distinctly in 1951 being out in Ballyhigh on the Roundy Landers. And any of the major matches that we were playing in, at least in terms of the semi-finals, we were brought together. So this new experience was not something which the Kerry team were adapted to. Now, Meath, on the other hand, they were all in a small community, really. You didn't have these peninsula, etc., and the mountains of even Kerry, so that they were ideally training as usual.
So when 55 came, Sean, you were, as I say, coming out of a very bad year, was there despondency within football circles, and how did you feel about the prospects of 55?
I didn't feel pessimistic in the strict sense of the word. Optimism was not something which was rife in the county of Kerry at the beginning of 1955. There was an air of despondency, and there was this feeling of 53 being a flash in the pan after 46. So that you're quite right in saying that the prospects were not rosy.
But there was a little bit of light because you had played Meath, hadn't she, in late in 1954.
Right. That is an interesting fact, because we played Meath in Mitcham Stadium before about 20,000 people, which was a huge crowd, and Kerry won decisively. And I recall that day as being of particular importance for John Cronin. He played a magnificent game, seemed to rally the team, and in my opinion, that was the spark that ignited the 55 victory.
What are your memories, Sean, your personal memories of early 1955? Where were you? You were going to university, I presume. What were your memories in your own personal life early in 55, the first 6 months of it?
My own personal memories are coloured by the Sigerson Cup, which is the university's championship, which we won. Actually, we played against Cork. And strange as it may seem, I played in Michael Connell that day. He was midfield for Cork and I was midfield for Dublin. The Dublin Championship was something which was, and the league particularly, was ongoing. So that we were playing football. I think that helped a lot to erase the memories of that 54 All-Ireland and gave us hope for the future. At least we were playing well, some of us. There were quite a number of Kerry people involved in the Sigerson, Cork and Dublin. I remember Tiger Lyons, Mick O'Connell. There was quite a few, I can't recall them at the moment. So that, we often spoke together about the prospects, and coming up to March and April, I had this feeling that the mood and the attitude had changed. We had become more positive and optimistic.
that particular time, Sean, 50 years ago, for the sake of our listeners, we must realise that everything was different and utterly different. Cork had beaten Kerry in the league match above in the Cork Athletic Grounds. You were missing that day. You were studying. And, of course, the league was taken completely different. There was no training for the league or anything at all like that. So what are your memories of getting together for matches early in the year?
My memory was that Kerry were a haphazard team. You never knew from one day to the next what the team would be. And that was a feature of the teams of that era. You didn't have the consistency that you had afterwards in these great Kerry teams of the 70s and 80s. Similarly with other counties like Galway and Mayo, there seemed to be a lot of team building going on. My own memory of, there were lean years, or the lean months, I should say, rather than lean years. The prospects of winning in All-Ireland, they weren't very good. They were never spoken about much. It was, I remember, not being playing against Cork and not being playing against Waterford afterwards. It was a time of exams in the universities, and obviously it was difficult to combine the two. So the exams came first.
And things weren't going well, Sean, of course, earlier on, because Dublin won all their league games. They beat Cork in the semi-final, and then they beat Meath in the final, 2-12 to 1-3. And 11 of their winning team were to start against Kerry later on. So things in the Dublin garden were very rosy, whereas you say, it was haphazard in Kerry. Fellas didn't know who would be there for the next match, and it must have been a bit depressing, really.
It was. Reading the papers, I was living in Dublin at the time and watching this Dublin, Vincent's team, really. They were truly a magnificent outfit. They had introduced something new to Gaelic football. And looking at them, they were building up this head of steam, which culminated in the 55 All-Ireland. They became almost invincible. You got the impression that country teams playing the traditional classic old-time football wouldn't compete with them. And that was a feeling, that was an opinion held by a lot of people, that Dublin were the form team of the decade, even at that early stage of the year.
Now, Sean, if I could turn to yourself again early in the year, January, February, March, April, May, up along like that. For instance now, you were picked and chosen on the team of the millennium, one of the best halfbacks the game has ever seen. Seamus Moynihan, of the present-day generation, would be the same. He trains every day, continuously every day. What type of training was Sean Murphy doing in early 1955?
It was dictated by other events. Gaelic football, always being an amateur game, always took second place to people's employment, study. It was essentially a game played during the summer months, particularly. My own attitude was I kept fit playing in the Dublin League and Championship. I trained spasmodically. Maybe 1 or 2 days a week, I'd get a bus out to Belfield on my own. There wasn't any consensus between the players about getting together and that sort of thing. But training was minimal. It was spasmodic. And there was no supervision of training. And it was up to the players themselves to condition themselves as best they could.
Sean, when you were a young man, did you have weight problems? Did you mind yourself? Did you smoke? Did you drink? In the early part of 55, now, could you explain to us what type of a person young Sean Murphy was?
I was very committed to personal fitness, very much orientated towards football. I took great care of myself in the fact I didn't smoke or drink excessively then. Maybe the occasional drink after a match. We were living in flats and digs in Dublin. Apart from the occasional meal played for by the county board, I'm afraid that meals and general care of oneself was, as I said, up to very much a personal thing. I, for one, kept very fit. I didn't have any weight problems. I was always kept myself about 12 stone 7, maybe 12 stone 10. Never went over 13 stone at that stage. I did a personal routine for matches in camp. I would walk along the rolls, do about 4 or 5 miles in an evening. I would climb the local foothills with my dog, and I was generally very fit.
The campaign of 55 began against Waterford. Now, you haven't great memories of that game because you weren't there. Where were you?
I was in England, as a matter of fact. I've just recalled that during my student years, we had to get some money together, and students generally migrated over to London for the season. And I was working as a porter in Waterloo Station at that particular time, therefore I wasn't there. But I listened in to the Irish news that night, and I was very, very relieved to know that they had won.
What do we know about that Waterford game, Sean?
That Waterford game was played on July the 3rd in Listowel. Again, an unusual venue for a Munster Championship match. We had the usual list, or the nucleus of the team that was destined to win the All-Ireland was forming then. You had Gary O'Mahony, Jerome O'Shea, Ned Roach, Donie Murphy, Colm Kennelly, John Cronin, John Dowling, Tom Moriarty, Paddy Sheehy, Bobby Buckley, Tighe Lyne, Gerald O'Sullivan, Mick Murphy and Tom Costlow. Very few changes eventually in the team that went on to win the All-Ireland.
And Kerry had a big win in that, hadn't they?
They had. They won by 3-7-0-4, which was a magnificent performance when you remember that this was a team in the doldrums after the 54 debacle against Meath.
Tom Costlow, somebody says, was in great scoring form that day.
I believe he scored 2 goals that day and went on right through the campaign and was a very fine performer. Played in the All-Ireland, you know.
And of course, Sean, it's important to point out that in relation to then and today, there was no training for that game. There was no get-together. There was nothing happened. Players simply turned up on the day.
That was quite true. You got a notification, and you made your own arrangements to get to the venue, which was Listowel in that occasion. But there was no training whatever, and you had no conception of what the team was going to be until you turned up. I didn't turn up that day, obviously. I was quite surprised to see the personnel on that team. Quite a change from the year before that, and certainly a lot of new names since 1953.
Now, we move on to the Munster final of that year. When did you come back from England? What are your memories of the run-up to the Munster final? Was there any training? Were you notified about it? Or how did the team get together?
I got a notification about that particular match, and I decided to come back home and prepare myself for the rest of the year. After seeing the result of the Listowel game, 3-7, that looked like a promising team. My faith in that team was justified when you recall that Munster final was played in Killarney July the 24th, and Kerry scored 14 points, and that was really, the pointer to the greatness of Tighe Lyne. His long-distance scoring feats were becoming a feature of what was established now as a feature of this Kerry team.
Himself, Tighe and Paddy Sheehy, I think, were the main scorers that day, weren't they?
Tighe scored 5 points and Paddy Sheehy scored 4 points, which is remarkable scoring against a good Cork team.
And of course, you beat Cork 14-2-6, Sean. What are your memories of before the game? Where did you tug out? Did you tug out in St Finian's, or was Dr. Raymond beginning to come onto the scene there? I know it's 50 years ago. It's not easy to remember little details like that.
I can't recall the precise details. I don't think Dr. Raymond had been introduced into the scene by then.
You hadn't even trained for this Munster final?
No, not to my knowledge. Yeah. No, we didn't. Kerry footballers weren't in the habit of getting together, except for semi-finals and finals.
And it was a blazing hot day, a massive crowd there, and as you say, you could even see, was there a bit of optimism now creeping into the thing?
Oh, yes, there was. And another fact, a salient point that I make, is that Cork team went on to win two Munster finals, 56 and 57. So that beating that team again showed you that Kerry were getting into a gear, were upping a gear towards the 55 final, which was, we knew nothing about then.
One man, Sean, that I must talk about, a clubman of my own, Donnie Murphy, who played in that Munster final. Met him lately, just before I did this interview with you. He buried his brother in Killarney a couple of weeks ago. He was asking for you. I was telling him I was going to meet you. But Donnie Murphy played his last ever game for Kerry, because going into that game, he was unwell, he was ill, and he spent the time in hospital. As a matter of fact, we'll be coming to it, you brought the cup to him in hospital later, but he finished up with TB, which he told me himself in his interview. But Donnie Murphy, great footballer.
Quite interesting, Donnie Murphy, dependable, a pillar of strength in the back line, durable, magnificent fielder. And that left foot of his, I can always remember the relief when that left foot connected with the ball. He was a marvellous footballer, and he was a tremendous loss to Kerry. And a strange thing was, Donnie was chosen on the team to play against Cavan, and he didn't play in that game, obviously. That was to be his last game for Kerry.
And the next game of football he played, would you believe, you won't even know about it. I was in goal for my own club, the Legion, in Castlevania in the county championship match in 1957. And he made his return to fullback. That was the first time I met Donnie Murphy. I'm a great fan of his. But nice to remember people like this, Sean.
Oh, particularly Donnie Murphy. What a fine character. Lovely personality. And as I said, dependable. My goodness, he was a power of strength.
Donnie, he was to miss the All-Ireland, of course, and Bobby Buckley played that day, and Dan McAuliffe also played that day in the Munster final, and they weren't to play in the All-Ireland final. The late Dan McAuliffe
was a superb footballer. His anticipation was uncanny. I recall more than one occasion saying to Dan McAuliffe, if I get the ball, well, that's a big if, during the game, I will play it, I will try and play it in front of you, diagonally across the pitch, so that you can collect it on the run. Did the same thing with Tygee Lynes, strange as it may seem. It was a feature of play that time, that this catch and kick sounds very, very unsophisticated, but this was kicking with a purpose and precision, and it worked. This idea that the Kerry backs or Kerry midfield kicked widely is totally unfounded. I can confirm that. This was part of a tactic rather than tactics, which would be a general statement of the type of football you played, the whole team played. But it worked with Dan McAuliffe and Tygee Lynes. They were unquestionably masters of collecting a ball on the run, turning and kicking it over the bar.
A new name now appeared, a fifth sub on the Kerry team that day. A young lad by the name of Johnny Cullity was added to the subs. Didn't come on in the Munster final, but the first appearance in a Kerry dressing room. Have you any recollections of this young fella sitting in the corner, Sean? Can you remember seeing this young fella?
I do. I can remember it quite distinctly. I remember looking at this young boy, I would call him, sitting in the corner. Johnny wasn't excitable, you know, even from the word go.
Still isn't.
And I remember inquiring about the personnel of the team, because you had Ned Fitzgerald was another person who was being introduced to the Kerry team at the time. But Johnny was not the type of person that you would think would leave the mark he did on Kerry football. He was a master stroke introducing him.
So the Munster final was won, Sean. Was there optimism then beginning to creep in? Could you sense an All-Ireland in the horizon? And was there talk among the players and the supporters? Or was there still a bit of pessimism?
The optimism was palpable after the Munster final. We all went back home thinking, this is a team that looked like the 53 team, capable of winning an All-Ireland. I can remember John Dowling and my own parish footballer, Dinny O'Shea. I remember speaking to these people, and for the first time, there was people saying, we can do it. Beating that Cork team was an accomplishment. As I said, they were a good team, and they went to two All-Irelands afterwards. I remember Paddy Harrington, God rest his soul, being a a prominent member of that team, as well as the Donovans and these. They were, that was a good team, that Cork team. So that did impart something into the spirit of the Kerry team, that this team began to feel as if they could go much further.
Now, Sean, you were in the All-Ireland semi-final, so were Dublin, of course. Dublin had hammered Meath in the Leinster final. They scored something like 5-14 to 1-6 or something like that, and they were the talk of the place. You were living in Dublin, going to school in Dublin. Have you memories of the Dublin people saying, well, this is our year? Were Dublin the talk of the place?
Dublin were, and deservedly so. I saw that Dublin-Meath game, and I remember being mesmerised by the activities and the off-the-ball running of the Dublin forwards. Another thing that impressed me about the Dublin team was they were big. You had Jim Lavin and Jim Crowley and Mark Wilson and McGuinness. They were very big men. And then they had these forwards who were, some of them were slight, but my goodness, could they run? And could they combine? So there was a Dublin team that was looking very, very dangerous.
And of course, the younger generation today might find it funny to think that there was no such a thing back there as a roving full forward. But Kevin Heffernan was starting the roving full forward.
That's right. Kevin Heffernan began to move outfield and create consternation among the backs. It appeared that Dublin had seven forwards. He appeared to be bobbing and weaving and turning up about two places at the same time. It seems funny now, but he certainly was a superb innovator. He introduced something new into Gaelic football.
Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Dublin were beginning to look unbeatable that year.
They were. And the reality was that you didn't have a team in the country that appeared capable of containing them. That was even worse than they looking unbeatable. The only weakness I could see in that team was, I asked myself the question, how could a team like Dublin, or anywhere, just keep running for the full hour? And I think that probably was the weakness that showed up in the All-Ireland final in the end, when Kerry appeared to be a much fresher team in the end. For the first 40 minutes of any game, Dublin were mesmerising, with the fluidity of movement, and their control of the ball was superb as well.
And of course, they were dubbed the Dublin Machine.
They were. It was a well-oiled machine. Peter O'Reilly, the trainer, seemed to have really produced a good team. And as the summer progressed, they seemed to improve with every game. And they had an excellent PR going for them as well, because they create an impression around the country of an unbeatable team. And that was the word which was most often used.
You must have been highly impressed as you sat down in Croke Park, or stood up in Croke Park, wherever you were that day of the Leinster final, Sean, and I suppose you were looking at them and you were saying to yourself, we're not going to win the All-Ireland Dublin Art. Would I be right or wrong in saying that?
You're perfectly right, because I remember being at the match with a couple of friends of mine, and one of them looked at me and he said, nobody's going to beat that team. Nothing's going to beat that team.
But you were in Dublin now. You were playing Cavan in the All-Ireland semi-final. What are your memories of the lead up to the match? Did someone tell you to train? Or were you notified about coming training? I presume there was still no collective training. What was the build-up to this match then, Sean, this big game against Cavan?
Personally, I began to realise that my degree of fitness would have to improve after the Munster final and after seeing Dublin. Of course, we were in Dublin. We'd seen all these teams begin. Some of the Carlow were a team at that particular time, which are quite impressive. And you formed an impression that if you didn't step up your training, you were going nowhere.
Sean, I'm getting the impression, that's a very interesting point you made. You knew that you weren't fit enough, for the All-Ireland semi-final, and I would presume that the same thing applied to the rest of the Kerry players. So, coming up to the semi-final against Cavan, the team were blatantly unfit. There was no collective training brought in at the time. No,
that's quite true, Vichy. I think this impression was created in the minds of most of the Kerry team, that if they didn't take an interest in their own fitness, that there was no point in being on the team. I can distinctly remember training about 3 or 4 days a week, going out to Belfield in the afternoons on my own, getting a ball, running along the sideline. I was playing right half back then, and I believed in running along the sideline on the half back, on that side, on my side of the field, with soloing at one leg and down the other, to get a mental picture of my sector of play, which was a word which Eamon O'Sullivan introduced very, very shortly after our experience that I'm talking about. And I can remember being physically ill on more than one occasion during the lead-up to the Cavan game.
Sean, you actually trained along the sideline to reproduce what you'd be doing during the match, because, as you said, Dr. Eamon said, stay in your own sector.
That's right. Dr. Eamon had impressed upon us in the 53 All-Ireland that your sector was your responsibility, and you had a mental picture of that. Just if you're driving a car and you're in a tight squeeze, you can't look left and right and front and back. You drive instinctively, so you get an instinctive feeling for your position on the field.
Of course, you had a small bit of help before the game because a Kerryman threw in the ball. We'll talk about that. And for the sake of our listeners, the throw-in that time was completely different than the throw-in is today. Tell us about the referee. Was Willie Goodison. He didn't throw in the ball.
No. Bishop Minehan, the Bishop of Kerry, threw in the ball. We were all together in the middle of the field. The backs didn't go back the same as they do now. There was a scrum, really, in the middle of the field. And we all raced to our positions. The game was on.
Who were you marking, Sean?
I was marking Sean Boyle, Dublin. It's very good football, very clean. I must say that Dublin team behaved admirably. There wasn't one unpleasant incident during the whole hour. Sean Boyle, I remember, he scored 3 points, which is worth stating. They were that type of team. They were running, interweaving with each other, and at times you didn't know whether or which, who you were supposed to be marking. But eventually you had John Cronin, Jerome O'Shea, Ned Roach, Mixie Palmer. You had this stabilising influence of every football, particularly the backs on each other. You knew that even if they ran riot, that at some stage they were going to run into an impasse, which was Jerome O'Shea, Ned Roach, you can still remember them.
There was a record attendance at the game, Sean, wasn't there?
There was
87,000 people. The gates were broken down. Another 10,000 got in.
Somebody said there was 100,000 there that day. I wouldn't be sure, because nobody could estimate the number of people that came through the gates which they had forced.
And the happenings then for the next hour, it's an hour of glory really for Kerry. Tighe Lyon with his 6 points, Jim Brosnan. And what are your memories of the actual game then? Of course, it's their stark crystal clear there.
I can visualise things like Tighe Lyon's picking off points from 40 yards, Jim Brosnan racing through, 2 surging runs there early in the second half. I can see Ollie Freeney and John Cronin engaged in a tussle, John Cronin won. I can see Jerome Shea making those fantastic clearances he did. Gary Mahoney in the goal, making wonderful saves. Paddy Sheehy. Right, I could go through the whole team.
And we can't forget our captain,
John Dowling. I mean, the way he performed at midfield with my old schoolmate, Dinny O'Shea. What a performance the two of them gave that day. They completely overwhelmed the Dublin midfield and gave Paddy Sheehy and Tighe Lyon and John Joshin, that gave them a field day.
You were coasting to win, Sean. You played tremendous stuff. As you said, Dublin were wilting. You won eventually 12 points to 1-6, but it should have been 12 points to 6, really, shouldn't it?
I think so. That goal was a very strange affair. I saw Freely, take that free.
14.
And I can see the ball in the back of the net. And I just do not know how it got there. But it did. And that changed the course of the game. Eventually, it suddenly caused Kerry to wake up. And they finished very, very strongly. I think Dublin had run themselves off the field, but they're passing and weaving and running off the ball. And Kerry had the endurance and the stamina to make the last 10 minutes very exciting, nail-biting, memorable, but eventually culminating in a victory for Kerry.
Unfortunately, Tom Moriarty was badly injured after 10 minutes. John Joe Sheehan came on. And also, another thing I wanted just to put you, Jim Broston played his first game in the Championship.
That's interesting. Jim was supposed to come for the semi-final. We were very disappointed when he didn't turn up. Of course, when he turned up for the final, that was... He had an individual magnetism. He was a great man to inspire the team. John Joe Sheehan came on for Tom Moriarty. I can still see Tom Moriarty, and he was settling down to a marvellous game, Tom. Another feature of the type of the style of football which Kerry played then, if you read the accounts of some of the game going right back to the early 50s, you can see where people had the impression that Kerry were an ignorant catch and kick anywhere, but that's not true, because if you read through the reports on these games, you will notice that Aback, John Cronin, Colin Kenley, Ned Roach, that they generally followed by a descriptive term like a long delivery, a long clearance, a relieving kick, found Tighe Lyne, John Joe Sheehan, Dan McAuliffe, and they kicked the ball straight over the bar. Now, this is a feature of Kerry teams in the past, which I think was an All-Ireland winning formula for them. Catch and kicking with precision and distance, relieving and forcing the other team to use a lot of energy, bringing it right back again to where the last attack had foundered.
What are your memories of the aftermath when the full-time whistle went? And the field, as usual, of course, was swamped with Kerry supporters. What are your memories of that and the cup and going into the dressing room after?
Pandemonium was the word I would use. We were swamped by a sea of faces that seemed to get into the... Then it was much easier to get into the park itself rather than today. And being lifted shoulder high by two or three or four people, actually they almost tore you apart. And seeing John Dowling receive that cup to rapturous applause. And I must give credit, Dublin took that defeat with graciousness, which I've never forgotten. There was no bitterness, no recriminations. They just accepted defeat. Mind you, whether they'd say they were beaten by better teams, contentious. That's another day's discussion with some of the Dublin team.
What did the Kerry supporters mean to you that day?
Everything. Everything. Looking around at those green and gold colours, seeing these wave after, they created the Mexican wave years before it was given a label, and to hear them cheering every movement, but then the silence when Dublin got the goal and the Dubs were at it.
What was it like in Port? Did you return to the hotel in Portmanic then that night? And what was it like there and then the following morning?
We had the Kerrymen's Association Dublin had a banquet that night. And the teams were there and the crowds were again evident there. I think we had it in Malahide. The crowds were swarming. Compliments were paid by various speakers. The teams were continually writing autographs. All in all, it was celebration, victory, celebration, preparing for the journey home.
Now, when you said preparing for the journey home, you were looking forward to that, and it was some event, there were some memories, because the place was a sea of emotion, wasn't it?
It was a sea of emotion, exactly. We got on that train, I don't know how we got on the train, the crowds see us off in Euston. And Houston station were enormous. The cheering when we got on that train all along the way. I can still see people in Portlaoise, Limerick Junction, but when we got to Killarney, along most of these places, in Rathmore, Mill Street, Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan got one member of the Kerry team to go out and just say a few words until we came to Killarney, and then that was it. We all got off the train and then set forth for Tralee. How we got out of Killarney beats me.
But of course, at that particular time, Sean, and up until the 60s, maybe early in the 70s, the crowd were allowed onto the platform. And of course, you came down in the old steam train, didn't you?
Right, we did indeed. Well, that was a happy memory of mine. The crowds in Killarney, they were enormous. That's all I can say. I think the whole town and the hinterland turned up in Killarney that day. Dr. Damon spoke, John Dowling spoke, and it seemed as if they didn't want us to leave. But then we had to come to Tralee, John Dowling's hometown. Another reception unequalled in my experience.
When did you get the cup back to camp?
We had the cup, we had a celebration in camp in December, and Dr. Raymond came along, Frank Shee came along, and...
Frank was the county board chairman.
He was the county board chairman. We had a marvellous night. Turkey, ham, oh, that was, it was a homecoming. It looked as if the homecoming went on from the last Sunday in September to the 1st of January.
And the week after in the Kerrymen, the great writer P.F. summed it probably all up. There was a headline emblazoned across the Kerrymen: Up Kerry, up catch and kick, up Dr. Eamon, up Kerry football.
Yes, it was a momentous occasion. And the superlatives that were written about the performance.
And songs written.
And songs were written.
Gary McMahon's dad wrote a song.
He wrote a song. I remember these songs being sung and I remember reading them. It brought out something in the Kerry people that was dormant. I think it was in 1946 when they won the previous All-Ireland. They won one in 53, which could have been classified as something almost like a fluke. But 55 confirmed that Kerry football was, as it always had been, unique, distinctive, and wasn't destined to change. I think it proved that Kerry football could compete with and cope with any developments in the game. Admittedly, you can get great teams like Down and Galway coming along, but over the years, this style has persisted and has been victorious on 31 occasions, hasn't it?
What was that 15, Sean? You might call it out for stare. I know that you have it in the top of your head, and maybe you have it behind your head or under your arms or something.
Oh, it's a pleasure to remember Gary O'Mahony, Jerome O'Shea, Ned Roach, Mixie Palmer, well, Sean Murphy, John Cronin, Tom Moriarty, John Dowling, Denny O'Shea, Paddy Sheehy, Tom Costello, Tiggy Lyon, Johnny Cullity, Mick Murphy, Jim Brosnan, and John Joe Sheehan, who replaced Tom Moriarty. And the subs, Bobby Buckley and the Dillons, Marcus O'Neill, yes. They were something to remember.
Sean, how or did that 1955 win affect your life? What mark has it left in you?
It was probably in my football career, I think it was the acme of my association with Kerry football, and I'm including 1959 in that. It was a momentous occasion. It did something to relive the Kerry dream of winning an All-Ireland every year if they could, but certainly one every 3 years or so. I felt I joined an illustrious group of old Kerry footballers. I felt this team had left an imprint, and the imprint was that football as played Kerry style, influenced by Dr. Raymond and influenced by the older footballers, Paddy Kendy, Sean Brosnan, Billy Casey, Con Brosnan, D. Connor from Killarney. Oh, I could go on naming these. To be part of that bunch of people made me very proud to be associated with them, and instilled upon me some values that remain with me right through to today.
As your life continued and you continued your profession in medicine down through the years, and looking back now, would 1955 come up when you talked to a patient or a fellow doctor, or would you meet a friend? Would 55 always surface?
55 will always be synonymous with an epoch-making event. There was a new style of play came up against an older tradition, and the older tradition survived the contest. That was important, because since that's over 50 years ago, probably nearly 60 years ago, and looking on the All-Ireland last year, they won that football game because they played a classical, old-style game of football with a few innovations. Nothing remains the same forever.
What more apt way to finish our interview. Dr. Sean Murphy, I want to thank you sincerely for taking the time out to talk to me. And on behalf of Kerry followers and Kerry supporters everywhere, I want to thank you for bringing us back to 50 years ago, to that year of 1955, and recording, remembering, and telling us what happened. Because, listen to me, it was lovely talking to you, and on behalf of all the Kerry team, indeed, that particular day you were speaking. So, Sean, thanks very much. It was a great honour and privilege.
Weeshi, it's been a pleasure. And thank you for interviewing me, and may I say, your contribution to the Kerry football story is immense. I hope people appreciate what you're doing for it. I certainly do.